afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and I am flying solo this week as Scotty Hertz is on assignment. Anyway, he will be back next week or the week after. It's very busy time in Scotty Land. In the meantime, you get just me, so that's a treat. Moving on, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk the latest in news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and even sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week, that will be Dan Gibson, the Ward 1 councillor here in Guelph. And we're going to talk about the great debate around the harm reduction housing proposed site at 106 Beaumont. It's going to be almost 30 minutes just on that one issue. And if you're concerned about that issue at all, whether on the harm reduction side or the development side, I imagine some people are going to be tuning in. It was posted on Dan Gibson's Facebook and social media earlier. So that should be a very insightful discussion, I think. It will be, however, at the bottom of the hour. First, we are going to hear a voice from away, and that is Jenica Atwin, who is the third elected Green Party member of Parliament, the very first from the East Coast, and the first woman to win the riding of Fredericton in New Brunswick. And she is also the first member of Parliament to appear on Open Sources post-2019 election. So we're going to cover a lot of ground. It was very great to get a chance to talk to her. She seems super enthusiastic about getting started in the House. And without further ado, let's hear from Jenica Atwin. So Jenica Atwin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I guess maybe the first most obvious question, given your position, is you're the first Green MP from the East Coast, from Fredericton. So why Fredericton and why now?
I mean, that's kind of a burning question, I think, for a lot of people's perspective. There was just so many components that really came together. You know, we can't deny the fact that our Green leader here in the Fredericton South, you know, provincial jurisdiction, David Kuhn, had so much to do with it, just kind of leading by example and really connecting with people and being present, just showing, you know, kind of what Green politics is really all about. So I think, you know, that had a major impact. And that's so much of what we heard early on in the campaign is just how much David was doing and wanting to see that on a federal level and what that would look like even as, you know, collaboratively with David and I together was very exciting to people. So that certainly had, you know, a bit to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think as well, the PEI Greens, the momentum there, I think that the East Coast has been a bit primed up now to see, you know, that they can, that voting differently can, you know, heed the results that you're really looking for. I think they're very happy with how their Green representatives have been working for them on with their best interests. And so that was a big part of it. I think also just timing wise, in Canada and, you know, in the Maritimes, as far as climate change being a top election issue, people were far more aware because of the flooding in our area, just at how pressing that this issue actually is, and that it does impact them in a, you know, in a real immediate way, rather than it being someone else's problem or something they might see in the media. It's now absolutely a top concern for so many of our residents living along the Willistook River. So that had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just people were ready. I think they just wanted change so much, you know, in the New Brunswick system, we just kind of had this back and forth with red and blue. And we really did our best as well to kind of combat the whole strategic vote conversation and really just open people's minds up and encourage them to vote with their heart as well as with their head. We think we're also the smart choice for a lot of reasons. And
right.
A lot of our priorities really align with the direction that they wanted to see things head in. So I think it's just a combination of all of those things, as well as Fredericton being, you know, a university area. So we've got University of New Brunswick, we've got St. Thomas, we've got MBCC, some other institutions. So the youth vote, the youth support, the youth voice was so, so important. And I think with my background in education, perhaps my age as well, had a lot to do with really tapping into that incredible demographic and the power that they bring to the conversation.
Yeah, I would imagine that's true, because a lot of young people could see themselves in a few years being the next Jenica Atwin. Hearing you explain all that, though, I know that there are a lot of people who, you know, working for the Greens as you know, organizers, as activists, are trying to find that, I'll use the expression magic bullet, trying to find the thing that can lead to more Green MPs across the country. Is there anything, you know, maybe, and I'm sure you've gotten this question a lot, like, what was the alchemy in Fredericton, and what was the alchemy that you know, you brought to it that maybe politically can be transferred to other places? Or is it just like a matter of you were in the right place at the right time to capitalize on all this?
I think what it really comes down to is surrounding yourself with an incredible team. It's not just about me in any way. It's about the people who I trusted, who share the same values, the same kind of work ethic that I was able to kind of surround myself with. And that was due in large part because of the structure and organization of the Electoral District Association. So having a well-established EDA, mm-hmm. Starting off with a bit of funding, a bit of structure, some expertise, all of that very much contributed to our success here. So that would be my advice for people, across the ridings, to say, surround yourself with a good team and mm-hmm. have a well-established EDA. Those are critical things to a successful campaign.
I imagine, too, and maybe this is my own political point of view on this, it shouldn't be terribly surprising, at least not to me, that, you know, the growth of the Greens politically, and not just you, not just Elizabeth May and Paul Manley in Ottawa, but, you know, in PEI, where there's a Green opposition, in New Brunswick, where there are several Green MLAs as well. It shouldn't be that surprising that in terms of the concern about climate change, the areas that are most concerned are along our coastal areas.
Mm-hmm. And I think, honestly, we tested a theory mm-hmm. Where when we were canvassing, just to see, you know, as far as issues, you know, that we're kind of discussing at the door, and so many of the small neighborhoods that had brooks or streams or, you know, just a close proximity to water, mm-hmm. their concerns were far more heightened than other neighborhoods that were more kind of landlocked. And so it's a really interesting thing to see happening. But absolutely, you know, we're on the coast. We need to be concerned about this right now, because it's, you know, it's not just the distant future. It's quite immediate.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about some of the news. There was the cabinet swearing in yesterday. And a lot of the talk was about matters of what they're calling Western alienation. I'm wondering about Eastern alienation, because I was reading some of the interviews you did, and you've talked about how maybe the Green Party was too West Coast focused before. Is there maybe a correction here that, you know, there is maybe some East Coast alienation, especially in regards to maybe some of the climate issues and rising ocean levels and things like that?
I mean, I think there's always been an East Coast alienation. We're kind of a forgotten part of Canada oftentimes. And so that's such a big priority for me, is to be a loud voice for the Maritimes and really kind of get together with my fellow Atlantic MPs and try to drum up more of that support and show that we have a strong voice and a really important perspective, especially when it comes to climate change. So, I mean, I certainly feel for the economic situation that's happening in Alberta, but it's a little bit like, you know, we've kind of felt that pain for such a long time. So I hope that they see that as kind of empathy, and maybe they can, you know, we can kind of bridge that gap a little bit, because I think it's, you know, unity is really the focus, where at least it should be in Canada right now. And as far as kind of the cabinet, announcements, it would have been nice to see a little bit more Atlantic representation. I was certainly sad to see, Jeanette Pennypah-Taylor not return as our health minister. It would have been great to have a fellow woman in New Brunswicker to be, you know, in that important role, especially in some of the issues that we prioritize here in the Fredericton riding in particular. So I think that, change is good in its own way, but, again, certainly would be nice to have a little bit more representation in that cabinet from the Atlantic voice. So it's now up to us as the Atlantic MPs to be really loud and to talk a little bit more about that, you know, how we have been left out in a lot of the conversations. And, you know, our economies have been struggling for quite a long time. And so, again, we hear you and over in Alberta, but we've got some issues here, too, to be addressed.
I wonder, too, if... how difficult that's going to be to work not just across parties, but across regions, because it really feels like in the moment we have now, It really is sort of being pitted region against region, and maybe that's partially our fault in the media, and maybe that's partially the fault of the politicians that maybe they're not doing enough. But, you know, from your perspective in terms of trying to work together across lines and across regions, how difficult do you think that's going to be?
Well, I mean, the media certainly does have a role to play. And so, you know, it's about that kind of that narrative, whether it's national narrative or regional narrative. It's important to kind of control some of that. But it's just, I mean, I actually, you know, as a history buff, I've been actually reviewing some of the debates around Confederation, kind of the original regionalism and the alienation and the issues surrounding that. So it's interesting that we kind of see history repeating itself a little bit. And it's important to understand, too, the role of the Senate in all of this. And the Senate is meant to kind of balance out some of that regionalism and be that strong voice for maybe the Atlantic provinces or even representing Alberta. So I think it's kind of returning faith in our democratic institutions and ensuring that we kind of operate in a way that's really, you know, surrounding good governance in particular. But, you know, I'm very proud of our federal model, and I want to protect it. And so I think that's really where the conversation needs to head is what's Canada's identity? What direction do we want to head together? And we can't leave Albertans behind. We can't leave the East Coast behind. So we've got to find solutions across party lines to just make this work. And in a minority government situation, I think it's a beautiful opportunity to increase the diversity of voices and perspectives and really help to appease some of the uneasiness that exists. But it's going to take a real focus again on that unity piece. And so you know, no one wants to go back to election. We've got to figure this out, and we've got to get to work because there's so many pressing issues right now that need our attention.
You mentioned minority parliament, and I noted this yesterday with the cabinet announcement, and I'm sure you did too. There's no more electoral or a democratic reform minister. That seems to be gone, and it seems to be sending the message that, you know, electoral reform, which I know has been a long time Green Party platform piece, that's going to be a tough argument if there's no person in cabinet who's going to be, you know, looking after that file.
Mm-hmm. I kind of first had an inclination that it was going to be dropped when I received the list of committees, and it's no longer a parliamentary committee either to have to focus on electoral reform. So it is a little discouraging because, I mean, again, we would have seen far more seats across Canada that were green if we had that proportional representation or at least some sort of you know, electoral reform in different varieties. So it's not a conversation that we're willing to drop. It's something that Elizabeth May addressed right away after election in her letter to Prime Minister Trudeau. So I'm not sure how we're going to kind of bring it back into the forefront, but there are so many people across Canada within the Green Party, within other parties as well, that realize that this is really actually can prevent some of that alienation from occurring. So it can actually directly speak to some of the issues that we see in Alberta. So it's something that's necessary to drum up again as an important cause for Canadian democracy. And so we're going to have to work hard where there's no like official, you know, platform now to have these open conversations.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned her at least twice now, so we should talk a little bit about Elizabeth May, who's the leader in the House, but not of the party. And what do you think? Let's talk about her legacy, first of all, because I think in, you know, probably in no small way, you wouldn't be here without her sort of paving the way. So what has Elizabeth May's tenure as leader meant to you as a Green politician and as a maybe a fellow woman in politics?
Well, I mean, so much. I absolutely wouldn't be here without Elizabeth. She was part of convincing me to become a candidate to begin with. I said no a few times to our local EDA before I actually was able to sit down with Elizabeth here in Fredericton, and she convinced me. Her leadership on, you know, just environmentalism as a woman, as a female politician, as a mother in politics, these are all things that have, you know, kind of been beacons for me in deciding kind of my future down this path. And her legacy is actually has a lot to do with that good governance I'm speaking about. She's so committed to what Canada can be, to some of the reforms that we need to have. I thought that actually, you know, standing up for Speaker would have been the perfect fit for her, to kind of control some of the things, especially that people don't like to see, the bickering back and forth. And she would, you know, I think she would really bring some grace and some class to that all-important Speaker position. I don't think that's going to be on the table for her anymore. She's kind of discussed that. But she's just such an incredible person. And every time I have the opportunity to hear her speak, she inspires me more and reaffirms, you know, why I'm doing this. And so I'm so proud of her. I'm so proud to have the opportunity to learn from her. And, you know, whether she's our our leader of the house, or just someone I can hopefully call a friend. She's going to have a lasting legacy for Canadians.
Mm-hmm. So looking ahead to, I guess, the immediate future of the party, we have Joanne Roberts as the interim leader. Any thoughts? I mean, I don't need you to name drop or anything, but it strikes me that, and we talked about this a bit on the show a couple of weeks ago when Elizabeth May announced she was stepping down, that it's hard not to notice that she was the one female federal leader. And I imagine that's going to weigh pretty heavily on maybe who gets involved and who gets support. But I mean, just generally, you know, what are you going to be thinking about when you're thinking about who the next leader of the Green Party is going to be?
I mean, of course, it's great to continue kind of the representation of having strong female leaders. And, you know, I thought that they actually didn't give her enough credit for being the only female leader during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, while I don't think that's necessarily a criteria, I think it would be nice to continue that. but I think we're also looking for even more diversity. We want people to really represent someone who represents Canadians. And I think that that's what that means is actually changing and growing. And I think that we should be very open and inclusive when we consider who our next leader is going to be. And I think there's a lot of really great people who have actually already kind of stepped forward to, you know, potentially think about being in the running. And I know that there'll be a bit of a short list around April. So I'm really excited to see who that will be. I've met some really incredible former candidates, some people who are just involved in the federal council as well. So I think we're going to be in great hands. But as far as, you know, the qualities that I'm really looking for, it's that kind of energy. It's a way to connect with people. It's a way to broaden the conversation. I think that sometimes we struggle as Greens to really be, you know, to open it up enough beyond our kind of support base. And that's really how we're going to win future elections. We need to make sure we're bringing in people from across party lines. And we were able to capitalize on that here in the Fredericton region because of our approach. So that's really got to be the skill set of our future leader, is someone who is about renewal and making it exciting to be a Green, but certainly just opening the floodgates so that our membership increases and that our support increases, you know, electorally as well.
Yeah, it strikes me that we've had the Green Party for years talking about acting on climate change, and it kind of took the issue coming home for that message to resonate. And I know that, Elizabeth May certainly came to Guelph a couple of times. Our local candidate, Steve Dick, talked a lot about it, too, that, you know, that this was a very important election in terms of guaranteeing climate action. And I'm wondering, looking forward, and this may be a bit pessimistic on my part, but, you know, how much of this is going to depend on, you think, getting more attention in terms of the seeing more of the reality of climate change? You talked about the flooding in your area, and that seemed to be galvanizing a lot of people. It seems like we're going to have to suffer a bit before the majority really takes it seriously and votes on behalf of climate change.
I think that's really sad.
Yeah.
I think the reality, and I mean, that happens, it swings through in a lot of different subjects, that we kind of have to experience it first order to think that it's a serious issue. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very worried that that's going to be the major tipping point. But I hope at that point, though, that all the other parties will also be taking up this initiative as their kind of number one concern. I was really happy to see that during the election that, you know, in our many debates here in the Fredericton area, that most of the other parties were making this a priority and talking about their plans and comparing whose was better. So we're heading down the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, you know, the voters and where they're kind of putting their X, I hope that all parties make it a top priority, so it's not necessarily going to let us down if we don't have the Green results in particular. So
right.
It's got to be an all-party concern. We didn't see that, again, in the announcements that was for the cabinet positions, that would be necessarily a main focus point for one minister in particular. Obviously, we have our environment minister, but there's a lot of roles that they have to play. So, sadly, I think that is the reality, that people are going to have to start feeling these effects to really take it seriously.
Yeah, and I wonder about that, too. And the thing about moving Catherine McKenna out of the environmental portfolio, and, you know, people are entitled to have her opinions in terms of her effectiveness, but I almost read that as kind of a I don't know, an admission of defeat, because she, like, it became so much about her, like, the negativity, the personal attacks against her, that, you know, no matter how strong she was in that file, to move her out and put someone new in, you know, almost strikes me as a admission of defeat in regard, in a certain respect.
I kind of felt that way, too, and I feel a little bit, you know, I feel bad. I think that... I think she was doing the best that she could in the kind of political climate that she was offered. It was a tough time to have that portfolio. We've seen a fair bit of misogyny, you know, that was headed her way and to her, some of her staff as well. The vandalism, the disrespect that she received, a lot of the social media attacks. So I feel bad, and I want to reach out to her as a fellow female politician, and just to know that, you know, can we get a kind of stand in solidarity, and especially where she did work hard, I think, on that file and do the best that she could. So it's tough. And oftentimes, too, when you see those shuffles, there's that learning curve for the next person coming in. And we just don't have time to wait on environmental issues. So,
right.
But it's not something necessarily new. We see these shuffles all the time. And we're just going to have to work with what we've got and hope for the best.
I do want to talk about you a bit, because it seems like politics was inevitable for you. Your father was a mayor. Your stepfather was the leader of the, I hope I pronounce this right, the Wallastoqwe First Nation.
Yep, close enough.
good. your husband is currently a member of the band council. Was it inevitable? Are you sitting here today as like in terms of, like, maybe not necessarily the specific seat, but in terms of being a politician, were you on a predetermined course, do you think?
I think so. I think that, most people who know me have known me since I'm, you know, from a young age or in school. This probably didn't come as a surprise to them that this is the direction that my life has taken. I didn't know when it would happen or the timing. How much my life has changed in just a year is pretty incredible. But I just think it goes back to me being, involved in student politics. And it's just something that I've always been interested in and drawn towards. And anytime I talked about kind of future plans or goals or dreams, it was always part of my plan. So it's just so great to have it kind of realized, especially during this really exciting time in history. And I'm just so proud to be a part of it and just kind of lend my skill set to be part of the momentum in Canada. And I'm really hopeful. I'm really optimistic. And that's really what we tried to bring to our constituency, is that let's focus on the good. Let's see what we can do. Let's not get bogged down in kind of the doom and gloom and the dread of what climate change can mean. But let's look at the solutions together. And I also think there's a great economic opportunity. So I've really been trying to pit those two together as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. Is that what doing politics differently means to you? Because I know that's a phrase that means a lot to a lot of green politicians.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think it's also just that kind of returning the human side of politics and really being accessible to our constituency and really showing people that, you know, I'm just a regular everyday New Brunswicker. I represent, the average person here. I'm a mom. I'm just, I think it's just showing them that, politicians are real people and they do connect to these real issues. And so maybe it's just about knowing they can reach out more, that they can have a voice, that there are mechanisms for them to be involved. And so that's the way I'm hoping to do politics differently. It's just that to be real. And I think that's what people want to see, and it's quite refreshing. And that's what we've been hearing from people so far.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to wrap up, I imagine it's a very busy time for you in terms of, any kind of transitioned into the new job has its share of challenges and demands. So what are you doing right now? Like, how is the orientation going? You know, what kind of things are you doing before the House sits again in a couple of weeks?
Well, so I've already done just my parliamentary orientation, going over things like your managerial role and different departments and resources that we can access. I'm being sworn in on Tuesday, which is really exciting. and then I've got a day of orientation about kind of protocols on the floor. So that's happening just before our first sitting date on December 5th. So I'm really excited just to kind of learn the ins and outs and the protocols and, you know, what to do, what not to do, and just to be as effective as I can, because you know, I know people were concerned about a shift and what that learning curve will mean for delays. And we just want to hit the ground running. We just actually released a list today about it being 1 month since the election and what we've been able to accomplish, all the organizations we've sat down with, all the constituency meetings,
intergovernmental meetings, caucus meetings. So we're just so proud of what we've already been able to do. So it's just it's still a learning process, and it's really exciting time. And we're just trying to kind of live in the moment and really appreciate this opportunity that we've been given.
You are right. It is exactly 1 month from the election. Time flies. Jenica Atwin, thank you so much again for your time, and we'll see what you can do when the House comes back into session in a couple of weeks.
Great. Thanks so much.
And once again, that was Jenica Atwin. She is the incoming Member of Parliament for Fredericton, and the House gets sworn in on December 5th, I believe. I know that our own MP, Lloyd Longfield, has already been sworn in. He has new digs on Farquhar Street in the old granary building, if you feel like reaching out to him if you need an assist on anything. That's where he is now. I think all the same contact information works, but if you want to see Lloyd and his staff in person, you have to go to Farquhar Street now. They're not on Cork anymore. That's a little inside info. Speaking of inside info, we will talk about 106 Beaumont Street next. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
We made love upon a bed, sat down to the floor in a room that had a postcard on the door of Marini's little man. With an erection on a horse, it always leaves me laughing, leaves me feeling that of course if this is sinking, I'm going under.
And that was a bit of Spirit of the West, Venice is Sinking, which is apropos in one way, because Venice is sinking. Not doing well so much with the climate change over in Venice lately, but also because, sadly, John Mann of Spirit of the West passed away this week. 57 years old, and he suffered from Alzheimer's, early onset Alzheimer's. So it's, yeah, it's hard to know what to say. You know, it's gone too soon. And Alzheimer's is, you know, tough way to shuffle out of this life. Anyway, life is tough, and there are a lot of people around who do know that, which is why the city of Guelph has been trying to pursue some harm reduction housing using containers as a kind of easy, quick, efficient, but still creating good quality housing for people who may need some support in the realms of harm reduction, people who are addicted or have mental health issues who are trying to recover, which is why a couple of weeks ago at Committee of the Whole, it was proposed by Councillor Rodrigo Galler to explore using surplus land owned by the city at 106 Beaumont to house 10 container homes. This was met with some degree of, well, shall we say, skepticism, some degree of concern. The city has its protocols for pursuing any kind of development. And one person voted no on that measure, and it was Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson. Granted, Beaumont is in his backyard. It is part of Ward 1. But he has some concerns. They seem to be being aired out outside of the council chambers. They will be aired inside council on Monday. But I got a chance to sit down with Councillor Gibson earlier this week to talk about the issue in depth, and here that sound is. I want to start just by going macro.
Sure.
Which is, I think there's a visceral feeling that comes from, this is a file that has not been well examined the last several years, that we've been waiting for higher levels of government to act, we've been waiting to see, take from their direction. So maybe this is where the emotions, at least for one half of this comes so high, is that finally we have council saying, we're going to do it for ourselves, we're going to, you know, if the province comes on board, great, if the feds come on board, great, but, you know, how do you feel, given that your role as councillor
and you know, how long was something like a project like this has come along.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on today, Adam. I really appreciate it. I enjoy your coverage of City Hall and this program for that matter. Long time listener, third time guest.
Fourth, if you count the election.
That's right, actually. So, yeah, very good.
All right.
Almost a generational problem we have on this file. And I think the mayor said it best probably a year and a half ago, where he said, you know, it's time for everyone to sort of get together, get unified around tackling chronic homelessness in our city, and stop waiting or stop saying it's someone else's problem. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a general spirit in Guelph to move the ball forward on this. It's something that has been lacking, the, you know, creation and development of rent geared to income or social housing in our city has been something that's really gone stale for the last few decades. And it's something that this council, I think, is unified on changing.
Mm-hmm.
How that looks, where it goes, who it services are unfortunately big questions. Mm-hmm. And those are questions that aren't quick fixes. However, I think it's undeniable that there's an appetite on council. You know, with the mayor's task force for targeting homelessness last year, I think we achieved 3 out of the 4 objectives.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth objective being that harm reduction housing is something that this is on our council agenda right now. It's on our plate.
Mm-hmm. To get to this specific motion that Councillor Gawler made,
mm-hmm.
it was you who said that, and you repeated this at the meeting on Thursday night, that council put a finger on a spot in the map, people are going to think it's a done deal. And I'm wondering if you think that was maybe self-fulfilling prophecy. you called it, and I think people took, you know, your cue, and maybe didn't like understand, you know, where you were coming from on that. But it's the understanding was made that
right.
Council had put their finger on the map.
So, council had. So this property came out of a surplus asset sort of report that came to council. It was a property that, through direction of council, can be investigated, can be sold or leased quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, the mayor said it correctly, we have rules in our procedural bylaw that allow us to fast track these types of procedures. So I will admit the day after the motion being somewhat of a surprise to me and definitely a surprise to the public. There was no notification,
mm-hmm.
No public awareness on the issue at all. Emotions were running high that evening following the vote, that I knew that people would be waking up the next day wondering what had happened and where this came from. So, yes, it was a little bit of straight talk from me, a little bit of plain talk. But, you know, I don't take it back because it was a 12-1 vote.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were the one for the record. Yeah.
Me being the dissenter, I really needed to stake out my position as to why I took that stand. And we know the easy narrative mm-hmm. in this city would be to say Dan's anti-homelessness or
yeah.
Dan's against this or against this. And quite frankly, I knew that narrative would get struck.
Yeah.
And I needed to make sure that my territory on the issue was straight and clear, that we have processes for addressing these types of things. We have processes for advancing. We have decision-making processes that give the due process to the public
right.
when they are hearing these news and they are being consulted on and engaged. And I felt like this gained so much steam and so much momentum in one meeting
mm-hmm.
without ever being able to consult my constituents that I needed to stake that territory up quickly. Being in the political world we are in, sometimes you're not always given the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
And so I needed to stake that territory properly before the narratives began.
Well, for the record then, would you feel as passionate about it if this was in the West End or in the South End, if there's this big parcel of land and Councillor Gawler said, let's put the finger on the map there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been accused of NIMBYism before. I've been accused of NIMBYism on this file as well. But I'll say this, you know, the constituents weren't even given the opportunity to become NIMBYs because it was being moved so quickly. So there was no opportunity for them to really voice their concerns or even really ask many questions. It felt like the decision was 2 steps down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I mean, it's a criticism that I've received around council before that I am a process guy. So if you go back and look at the way the plastic bag motion, the plastic bag ban motion came forward a few years ago, I did not stand in front of it simply because I didn't support a reduction of plastics in our community. I stood in front of it because of the way it came forward mm-hmm. and the way it was brought through a presentation to council, a late addition to the agenda, and then a surprise motion came out of it. So I like to think that if it was a motion that sort of came through a different channel, then I would oppose to it. And I always bring people back to this. I led a very public process on looking into whether or not we want to give homeowners a break on their driveways.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that through about a year and a half of public debate, of public back and forth, of interaction with staff and engagement with the public before we landed on a short-term and still a short-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my track record speaks for itself that I am a process-oriented decision-maker, and I think that the public deserves that as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is where process rubs up against, you know, expediency.
Sure.
That, you know, I think you would agree that there are everyone on council is well-meaning, and
I think yeah, in this file specifically, everyone's well-intentioned. Yeah,
right. And there's a desire to do things, and yeah, there is also the desire to get the good press from doing good things as well. But is you know, we're talking about homelessness. We're talking about again a file that, you know, we've had to literally blow the dust off of,
right,
in order to get any action on. And I think people see the action and not necessarily, and maybe this has to do with some of the mysticisms of City Hall too when it comes to the process. People mm-hmm. know what action is. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily see process as action.
Right. So glacial speed, right?
Yeah.
So one of my very proud files that still is working to its way towards fruition is the Emeco property.
Yeah.
So there's two ways to achieve this, and you made it quite right. A lot of the times, you know, we counselors and we want the public to know we're working on things, but we definitely do not want to make short-sighted and quick decisions that result in long-term mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unfortunately part of the process here at City Hall, that we measure twice and cut once. We just do. Sometimes we measure 3, 4, 5 times and cut once. And but we'd like to think that when we make that decision, it's done with due process and with transparency.
Yeah.
On the Emeco file, very similar. I would love to see that sod turning and that dirt turning today.
Right.
But there are processes that takes place, planning that has to take place before we can get that thing moving. I mean, I've talked ad nauseum on the project about where we're at. We're looking for the record of site condition with the Minister of Environment, Conservation and Parks. That is related to the, you know, the contaminants in the soil.
Yeah.
We need to somehow extract those, dig them up, take them off site, or go through a risk assessment to get that site developed. That takes time, but my desire and my plan and my hope is that when we do start turning sod there, it will be for real outcomes that will have long-term lasting 100-year impacts on the community. The decision around Beaumont, it wasn't a decision, it was a motion of council that was passed.
Yeah.
It still needs to be ratified,
yeah,
which I'm hopeful that there's some amendments coming. Was not only quick and rushed, but we hadn't talked about, you know, what about services? What about bringing in? What about development charges? How do we bring in water and sewer? How do we bring in hydro? Is the site appropriate? You know, is the site appropriate for the citizens that we're looking to support there? It is harm reduction housing after all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not social housing. It's not rent geared to income housing. These, how it was described to me was harm reduction housing. These are individuals that need a lot of support.
Yeah.
And is that in that sort of context, is Beaumont the best place for them, being that it's on the outskirts of town, being that it's going to need 24-hour supervision and supports? Those are all questions that we need to ask. We weren't granted that kind of time,
right,
last week.
Then I wonder then, I mean, there are so many questions, as you said, you know. I wonder, maybe we can address this first, the nature of the project, harm reduction,
sure,
housing. There's an immediate visceral reaction from people about you know, who that is going to be for, and for basically people who are drug users, recovering drug users. And I'm wondering, no matter where this goes in this city, isn't there going to be this reaction? I mean, no matter where the proposal is, no matter how long it takes, there's going to be this reaction, immediate, visceral, even angry.
I think what you're responding to is what you're seeing or observing. Mm. And again, I said this very clearly at the town hall last week. Full disclosure, one of the biggest reasons why I didn't actually formally invite the media to the town hall is because I knew some people needed to vent. Some people needed to have a free and open space to sort of say how they were feeling, even if it was wrong or if it was misunderstood. I did not want those quotes or those comments being attached to that person indefinitely. But quite frankly, I've said this to many counselors, we should have expected that response. The way we brought the decision forward, we were inviting that kind of knee-jerk response from the public. So that being said, when a decision is made and how we move forward with it, there are ways in which you can incorporate these types of harm reduction housing into your community where it's not a big hotspot in your city. You can small developments here, there. But the most important thing that I'm learning in speaking with the folks over at the Public Health Center is they do need to have close proximity to the services they require.
Yeah.
And that does not necessarily mean a trailer on site with a counselor working, you know, 9 to 5. We need 24-hour supports, wraparound coverage, access to healthcare professionals on a daily basis. And in those cases, most of the time you're talking about being close to downtown, being closer to downtown, simply because those are where the services are accessed. Yeah. So I don't have a site, I don't have a location. I have explored the idea of warming shelters or temporary warming shelters through the wintertime, especially in the wintertime when it's cold out, in local municipal parking lots, and whether or not we can bring in sort of 4 or 5 bedroom portables with sort of perhaps not plumbed, but safe individual bedrooms that can be locked so individuals can have their space, they can feel comfortable, and we can sort of meet that immediate need because of the cold weather. Those are still things that I'm having a back and forth with staff on. What's the permitting allowance, or what's the permitting process to get those things going?
I think one of the things that came out of the town hall that I found interesting was that, yes, there was tremendous passion, but I mean, everybody had sort of different perspectives. I mean, yes, there were the people who were very NIMBY, as you said. People were like, you know, the wrong place, wrong time, I can't let my kids outside. There were the people who were like, we are for something like this, but we don't like the process. There are people who are like, yes, there are people who need help, but is it, you know, is this the right way? And then there was the one gentleman who was talking about how, you know, there are people committing crimes, ransacking backyards, and trying to frame the homeless people, and it's just
that,
like,
was an interesting comment.
Yeah, it's this big ball of rubber bands that it's hard to pull one out, and, you know. But you're the one who has to make the decisions.
Yeah, welcome to life as a city councilor.
Yeah.
So I hope if anyone's listening and who came or would have liked to have come. I want to say again what I reiterated there, that there was a very wide spectrum of opinions.
Yeah.
There was a group at the front door that had some signs that were sort of, I think they made some assumptions about what the meeting was going to look like.
Yes.
And how it was going to sound. And I'm really pleased that they stuck around and stayed and listened to the concerns, listened to my comments, because I think there may have been some prejudgments around what I was going to say. So I really appreciated the dialogue from all members of the community. I think at the end of the day, the only common denominator that you could really find was that there was a genuine concern and compassion for helping people. How that looked, where it went, all those things are bigger questions, but I think our intents and our motives are in the right place. And so from there, we can move forward. Now, so when it comes to the people who are living in the encampments in the East End, I think there's 8 right now. I've actually got a constituent who's kind of mapped these locations for bylaw and for the police, because there is concern. The question is, will this harm reduction housing be targeting those individuals? Like, will that encourage them to come in? Because we know when we speak to individual cases that many of those individuals are choosing not to come to the shelters for whatever reason. their OW case numbers. They're identified individuals. We know who they are, but they simply don't want to come into the shelter system for whatever reason. They don't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
One gentleman has a dog. I'm not going to talk about individual cases, but how do we encourage them to come in to our care or come in and get support? And then hopefully you alleviate some of those pressures that are occurring in our suburban neighborhoods where, as I mentioned last week, you know, propane tanks are going missing this time of year because people are looking for heat. Those are all those things that, you know, you've got two sort of a suburban and an encampment world kind of colliding, and it's not going well.
You said you're a process guy. I think it's fair to say, and by all means correct me if I'm wrong, but you are a small C conservative guy.
You label me today.
Well, I mean, watching council for several years, sure. You get a feel for people, but this seems to me like the perfect classic example of too much regulation. That if something that's keeping somebody out of a shelter is that they've got a dog.
That's a great question for social services. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's in everyone's best interest, quite frankly, to have city councilors that are fiscally minded, quite frankly. We are not allowed to run deficits at the municipal level.
Mm-hmm.
So having someone who's got a fiscal conservative bent to them is not necessarily a bad thing. It may, in fact, be a blessing in disguise for councils who are, quite frankly, whatever you spend, you have to tax. There's no ability for us to run deficits operationally at the municipal level. So, whenever anyone tries to label me, I say sure. You know,
yeah.
label me what you want. But from a social perspective, I think Guelph's social conscience speaks for itself. I think we're all unified in trying to help people. We don't want to leave members of our community behind. That being said, how we approach that, you know, there's a paternal approach, there's a loving approach, there's a caring approach.
Mm-hmm.
We do have to encourage those individuals to come in to the shelters if it means trying to accommodate someone because of their dog or their, you know, their man's best friend or woman's best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Then we should try and see what we can do. But at the end of the day, I think we all need to make a decision that living rough, camping rough is not sustainable for our community, and we need to reach out and either have conversations or start informing them that we need them to be in shelter.
I heard Tina Bromfey say that camping is something you do when you have money. so to her point, though, it just strikes me that the way we think about this is like we'll build houses and we'll put people in them. We'll put everybody into a van and we'll drive them to a shelter. And it's not as easy as that.
No. Trust me, there's a depressing side of me that is scared that we will always have some people living rough.
Yeah.
Because they've chosen that path and there's not much we can do to bring them in. The issue that I have with it is when it's for reasons other than just a straight personal choice.
Mm.
If there are addictions or mental health issues associated with living rough, we need to try and work on those individual cases because, quite frankly, when there's criminality associated with living rough, then you're victimizing neighborhoods that otherwise shouldn't be victimized. You're having break-ins. I promised not to tell these stories last week simply because I did not want to paint individuals living rough as all criminals. That's by no means what I'm saying. But I, as a counselor, I do get lots of stories. I get calls once a week about stories about regular neighborhood families being victimized by individuals. I'm not putting blame to who they are, but maybe I'll stop there because I don't think it's fair to keep going.
No, and it's also as some people at the meeting were talking about that it's people who know where the homeless people are and can know that that's where the blame will fall.
So there are some elements of organized crime happening, especially in the east end of the city, around some of the businesses on Elizabeth Street, where it is quite organized. It doesn't look desperate. It looks like it's planned, and I know I'm reporting all that to the police, and there's lots of cases of that. So, I know for a fact that some of the live rough sites are resulting in some petty crime.
Yeah,
but by no means is it a black and white issue or a one and a zero issue. Yeah.
So coming out of Thursday's meeting, I find that sometimes these things just require an outlet to let off steam. Was your weekend a little quieter?
It was quieter, although, you know, you throw this on top of budget and you know, family life and my daytime career that I try and keep up with. It's been a busy couple of weeks on this file. I really appreciate the people who came out. Most have written and expressed thanks for giving the chance to come and learn more, to vent, to express their concerns. And they will be taking it, you know, they'll be going through their own democratic right and democratic process to write their concerns to council. And perhaps some of them will come and delegate. But what I've heard since with a lot of my counselors, and I do want to give some credit to a lot of counselors who've done some reflection on this motion. I really appreciate the mover of the motion, Councillor Guller, who's expressed some future sort of
adjustment.
Yeah, perspective on what occurred, and I really thank him for coming to the table, and him and I have had some great conversations on this. The mayor has some good perspective on this, and I look forward to I'm actually looking forward to the 25th now and moving forward unified, where we can hopefully have a bit more of a citywide approach to, you know, maybe setting a set of criteria first of what the site requires before going to look for the actual site, like setting some performance targets and criteria proximity to services before we go, again, put a finger on a map and say, what does it take to go there?
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen then on the 25th? And actually, let me just say this too, that isn't this kind of how the process works? Like something comes up at committee, we have that out, and then it comes back at council and we have it out again?
So I'll say this.
Okay.
Yes. However, it was a 12-1 vote.
Right.
We wouldn't be having, I don't think we'd be, I don't know that we'd be having this discussion if I had been missing from that meeting.
Hmm. Maybe.
So sometimes it takes a bit, in the moment, an unpopular stand, and I read the papers the next day. I read what people were saying, and I took a deep, big, deep breath. But I'm happy that we've had the conversation, but it did take voting no to that motion to get this conversation about process and about proper process and proper engagement started. So yes to your question. Usually this is how it works. But it's a little unconventional this time. Yeah.
All right. Let me throw this out too, because just from my perch at the media table, you've been making a lot of waves lately. You made waves with this. You made waves with going for parking, getting more money for parking.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's not new, by the way.
It's not new, but you know the spotlight has been on you lately. So how are we feeling?
It's the ebb and flow of council. Oftentimes, I will try and how do I say it? It is team oriented council. You know, you do not need to be, and you should not be, the sharp end of the spear on every single issue, simply because it is a collaborative approach. So it's my turn in the spotlight a little bit on these two things. But, you know, if you've been watching council for the last few years, I generally speak up during budget a fair bit more than I normally do. The parking thing has been something that I'd like to move towards a more equitable user pay system in our downtown. I don't think that's any new to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
This issue, you know, the Beaumont Street kind of found me. I didn't find it.
Almost literally.
That's
yeah.
Right. But, I appreciate it. You're a keen observer, so... Yeah, my turn in the go around, but
all right.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get back to normal soon.
Maybe to wrap up, you know, the people who sort of bring this full circle, the people who really do want action to help people who do not have a home. You know, what do you think the message will be next Monday?
Pause and think about that one for a second. I welcome their advocacy. I welcome their tenacity even. I did by no means shun them at the meeting last Thursday. I was happy they were there because I felt like they had something to offer the conversation. And I don't know if you remember, there was a couple times where it got a little heated where I intervened and said, listen, everyone has an opinion here and it's good to have that talk. And I was really personally pleased that I think it was about 10 individuals who came with an intentful purpose to sort of state their opinions And I'm very glad they came and listened to the other members of the group, because I don't think they heard what they might have thought they would have heard in advance of the meeting. So next Monday, I believe, I think that the meeting will be civil. I think council has a good intention moving forward on the motion. I look forward to supporting it and getting the action that the community wants. I will say this, and it's not a rebuttal at all. The one thing that I'm holding to, though, is that, you know, the mayor's task force on homelessness looked at emergency shelter beds and whether or not we had a shortage of emergency shelter beds across the city. And the answer came back to no. Mm-hmm. Now, I am happy to be stood corrected on that, but the last time I heard, the answer was still no, that we could find shelter beds. But I think in the cases of the individuals who are not going into the shelters because, A, they don't feel comfortable, or there's rules with the shelter they don't like, you know, that's something that we have to continually try and address. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping next week will be civil. I'm looking forward to hopefully a 13-0 vote to look at moving this agenda forward, just maybe without such a, you know, a foreshadowed spotlight on one part of our city, which again elicited the response that if you've, this is my fifth year now on council, second term, I could have predicted the response that we got. So anyhow, that's enough of that. I look forward to Monday. I think it'll be a good meeting.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much, Adam. Always a pleasure.
And so once again, that was Councillor Dan Gibson. Monday night at 6:30 is the council meeting that you're going to want to be at. If you're interested in delegating, you have to get that in by 10 a.m. on Friday. You have to email clerks@guelph.ca. You don't have to have a presentation ready and all that, but if you just want to speak, or even if you just want to send in a letter or an email of concern, clerks@guelph.ca, get that in by 10 a.m. on Friday and to be heard. Speaking of Councillor Gawler, he will be our guest next week here in studio, and we're trying to get some more of our local councillors in before we get to the end of the year. It is budget time too, so there's so much to talk about, so much going on. Stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. If you'd like to listen to the show again, download it from our website every Monday at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. Scotty Hertz can be found on Facebook and Twitter at Scotty Hertz, and you can find his blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com. DJ Sounds Good to Me is here at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I will be back for sure next Thursday at 5 p.m. to do another solo Open Sources, and we'll see you then.